This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Hello and welcome to The Morning Run, BFM 89.9. I'm Sharad Kutin with Melissa Idris and Julian Ng. A bit of a reversal of order. Usually it's Melissa saying this in early in the morning, but today I'm going to be hosting while Melissa, you know...
sits leisurely in the back seat.
Is that how you see things?
Yes, I do. I'm actually quite enjoying being chauffeur-driven this morning.
Oh, that's lovely. And of course, one of the reasons that you're in this leisurely position is that you're going to be interviewing Sigve Brekke. He is with the Telenor Group from Norway and is here for the WEF on ASEAN. Yeah. And so it's a big, big interview, and we're looking forward to what are the kind of main issues that are going to be brought up in this grill?
Well, you know, Telenor Group owns 49% of Digi.com. So, you know, they're one of the biggest telecommunications companies in the world. They've got operations spanning from all across Europe to Asia. But interestingly, a large part of their revenue comes from Asia. So I think one of the things that I will be talking to Sigve Brekke about this morning is what exactly is their focus in Asia? What is the game plan for Asia? And what does that mean for Europe? I mean, is that such a mature market that, you know, the growth in Asia is compensating for the lack of growth in Europe? A couple of things I'll be discussing.
Well, Julian, what do you think?
One very interesting comment that came out of him yesterday in an interview in a newspaper was that Digi would no longer be a telco in 5 years' time. And that is so interesting.
So what they want to do essentially is become a digital service provider. And, you know, what that means is kind of open to interpretation, right? So they don't want to just provide the platform for calling or for browsing the web on your phone. They want to make money from that. They want to monetize the ads, monetize the usage, monetize. They want to kind of be part of that entire ecosystem, shall I say. So they're moving in very aggressively into digital. Digi, I think, recently announced that they're going to start up this little division called DigiX, similar to like Google X. So they're going to be working on projects completely independent of Digi the telco. And they're going to be coming up with, you know, big ideas, things to monetize the digital platform.
Are they going to be producing content? Is that where it is? Or is it still a question of digital?
I don't think they need to go that far to make money yet, because they can focus on what sounds like an incubation business.
But also, very interestingly, they've made a couple of acquisitions that in the past year that I guess has piqued my curiosity. They've moved into the fintech space. So they've bought this Malaysian-based remittance firm called Prabhu Money Services, really kind of a local homegrown remittance firm. And Telenor has operations in India and Pakistan as well. So there's a lot of cross synergy there. They also perhaps may be looking at moving into, you know, not just remittance, but being part of the money services. So the fintech movement maybe want to take the place of banks even. So very interesting times for Telenor Group.
Yeah, are these conversations really important? I mean, are we getting basically in on a global conversation about where telcos are going?
Absolutely, and I think it's a kind of revolution that has been happening for a long time now, because the mobile companies, when they came to the forefront in the 90s, they had been displacing voice calls and the phone, fixed line phones, and mobile calls were displaced by SMSs, and now SMSs and calls are being displaced by data, and data is the thing right now. And I guess it's telcos' work cut out to see how they can fit into that.
Voice is passé, data is king.
All right. Another slogan to live by, at least for the next year and a half. Okay. Today's show on Ringgit and Sense, we have Rajan Devadasan, and he's going to be talking about cash, capital, and courage. I suspect this is more for the alliterative quality rather than the content. Or is it? Is it really about cash, capital, and courage?
Yes, it is literally, but it's also somewhat a philosophical discussion. I guess we need to have this kind of conversations once in a while to really get to the bottom of how we can understand how our investments work and what financial freedom really is. And I think it's going to be an interesting conversation.
You know, sometimes when I'm talking to people and I tell them I am with BFM and they go, oh, you know, I really... You know, I have money issues, and they tell me their personal problems, and the
strangers
hopefully want some solutions from me. But the thing that they ask me sometimes, it's really big questions. So how can I achieve financial freedom? And I'm thinking, wow, I can't answer this in the aisle of the supermarket. This is a huge question. So I tell them, listen to Ringgit and Sense on Thursdays.
Thank you for directing the traffic to that show. I believe that you will get something out of it as well as I have.
Well, okay, this is very interesting. Do people actually use the expression financial freedom?
Yes, yes.
Totally. They do?
Totally.
You know, yeah. I've never heard it. I've never had it sort of said to me in that way. I guess I've heard people talking about managing your finances, you know, securing your retirement. The very kind of, descriptive things. Financial freedom
because
sounds
really big. Because debt
is
the biggest shackle you can have in your life. You know, once you're in debt, it feels like this never-ending hole that you can't get out of. So financial freedom is literally that expression of relief to be independent of any kind of debt, right?
And the clearance of debt is the first step to financial freedom, but actually it goes beyond that. The strict definition of financial freedom, according to Rajan Devadasan, who's going to be our guest, is that the returns and interest and income that you make from your capital sustains you for your life without any work, without any extra work being done.
That's the dream.
All right. So that's the dream. and that's the kind of, I would say, utopic situation that people want to achieve. A lot of us would probably have to dip into our capital once in a while. But financial freedom really is when you don't have to do anything, any work or lift a finger, your income and interest sustains you.
I definitely will be tuning in for this episode for sure. 9:35. Right?
Yeah, that's
absolutely
right.
Okay, let's turn our attention to the what's in the news. Malaysia in the international news on the BBC website, you can find a story about a British man who's accused of pedophilia, but the crimes took place in Malaysia. He's actually very young, a guy named Richard Huckle from Kent. He's accused is admitted to abusing victims aged 6 months to 12 years old between 2006 and 2014.
Oh, wow.
He apparently abused up to 200 children. Now, what's really interesting about this story is that part of the reason that he was found out was that he boasted about his crimes on what they call the dark web. So, this interlocking series of forums and whatever websites that are kind of go under the radar. And I think that's what the dark web is. And
well, reportedly, he would come to Malaysia posing as a teacher, a photographer, even a philanthropist. And he would assimilate himself with the local community before abusing these children. And he would target poverty-stricken areas, especially not just in Malaysia, but also in Cambodia as well. Like you said, he went back and boasted about his activities online.
So he was tried in the United Kingdom, was he? Mm-hmm.
That's right.
He's
the British national. It's the crimes outside British jurisdiction. And perhaps British laws allow for these crimes to be tried, even if they're committed overseas, to be tried at home. And I think several countries have such laws.
Horrific.
That's a lot of charges and a lot of children. How many years were these crimes committed over?
I think 6 in total.
Almost a decade, apparently. Decade, but it did not come to attention of authorities in Britain until the middle of 2014.
So he has started these things
8 years. 8 years.
When he was very young.
That's right. He came here as 18-year-old, 19-year-old during his gap year. And that was the occasion for the beginnings of this. And he targeted boys and girls in this. It seems to be essentially about children, you know, regardless of their gender. That Egypt Air crash, apparently black boxes from the plane have been detected by French investigators.
Okay, well,
and if you just remember some of the details of that crash, it involved 66 people on board what was an A320 Airbus, and it happened on the 19th of May while flying from Paris to Cairo. Suspected cause of this crash is a terror attack.
Okay. Right. So I guess once the black box is recovered and they mine the data from that black box, probably know more about the circumstances of that tragedy.
Yeah. Okay, and kind of looking at the local front, the discussion around Hudud is, you know, hotting up as it always does. It's almost an annual affair now. Interestingly, the Malay Mail Online cited a paper coming from JAKIM, which is the Islamic, the Malaysian Islamic Development Department, that arguing that that Hudud laws could include all Malaysians, including non-Muslims, and argued that this was in fact ideal, that the authorities should be working towards harmonizing Islamic law with all laws, including our current penal code, and using Islamic principles, including hudud notions of how to punish a crime. And so, and also I think speaking to some of the criticisms being made now of the push for hudud, saying that you can't have a dual criminal justice system, that, you know, this difference will in fact cause problems. As you can imagine, since Muslims and non-Muslims very often are friends, and even, you know, partners in crime. They're not just partners in business, often, you know, also falling in love and marrying each other. We've worked out those scenarios. But what happens when they're caught committing a crime together?
So this was a paper reportedly from JAKIM.
Okay. Now, the Islamic Department, JAKIM, as well as the Deputy Home Minister, Noor Jazlan, were asked if such a briefing took place. They've denied it. But I think it'll take some time before we get to the bottom of this, and whether this is merely a suggestion, it's a paper.
I think this seems to me like a sure way of rallying all the parties together to kill the bill.
Well, you
I mean, it sounds so ridiculous that people would be so opposed to it.
BMI Research, which is part of the Fitch Group, they came out to say that this whole tabling of the Hudud bill, that was all part of a political ploy for UMNO to show up Muslim support ahead of the by-elections.
Well, you know, that's just, these are, I guess, risk analysts.
Commentators talking
about whether this is a serious move. But whether it's strategic or not, it really shifts the ground in terms of the thinking. And also, I think it reminds us of what the G25 group, you know, that grouping of former senior civil servants and people part of the establishment, noting the size and influence of the Islamic bureaucracy. And the thinking behind some of these papers will allow you to have a sense of what they think. And I don't think they think it's ridiculous or silly. They, in fact, think this is a serious proposition. And they look to other countries around the world, you know, states in Nigeria. Mm. Nigeria, of course, is a federation. Some of the states have Islamic law. They look at Brunei.
You know, Indonesia,
and I'm sure Brunei would like to see the replication of, you know, Sharia law in the region as well, to the extent that they could sponsor it.
So I really struggle with this, Gerard. I don't know how to react to it, because, you know, the Hudud debate resurfaces every few months or even every year, and the timing is always very suspect, because it always feels like, you know, it's resurfaced for a particular, you know, event. So I don't know whether to continue talking about it in the, you know, passionate manner that we often do every day on the show, or to just kind of put a pin in it and think, you know, this is an election ploy, perhaps.
It could be, but it does shift the ground. So if you look at other stories, including, you know, the way in which the Johor Royals and the Tunku Makota in particular have come out talking about, you know, the place of Johor in the Federation. So he's recently thrown down a challenge to his detractors, saying, well, okay, if you don't like what I'm saying, why don't you get the Prime Minister to take Malaysia out of the Federation? You know, just kick us out.
To take Johor out of the Federation.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Take Johor out of the Federation. I mean, mm-hmm. I don't talk about the Football League. I'm talking about taking the state of Johor out.
I mean, that was some strong comments coming from TMJ.
Yeah, and so, you know, let this genie out of the bottle, mm-hmm. you really sometimes can't contain it. So you might deploy it for strategic reasons like a by-election. I don't know if that's true, but at least that's a suggestion. It might not be so easy to put it back in the bottle. Mm. And I think that is the problem with the, in some sense, with this agenda that's unfolding before our eyes. Anyway, you're right. We talk about it very passionately every time it does come up. Whether it's going to really change things, we don't know, not at this point. But we'll be right back with more on BFM 89.9. I hope all our babies care, because, you know, and caring for babies is actually the subject of our next topic. I'm here with Julian and Melissa, and I, of course, am Sharad Kutan, if you don't recognize my voice already.
Ooh, I know. That famous voice.
I know, whatever. You know, moving along, I have, in fact, tweeted this, the link to the story. But just imagine this scenario. You're a very proud parent. Your kids like aced some, you know, major exam. The media's all over your kid, and they're kind of talking to him or her, and they ask the kid this very basic question: what's your favorite subject? And she says, or she says, political science. I say, okay, well, tell us, what do you understand by political science? Well, it's all about cooking.
And then,
absolutely. So that's what happened in Bihar, which is a state in India. A top student is interviewed by a local, television station, and he didn't get this right. In fact, he got it so wrong, it suggested that he really didn't understand what he was doing. And that led to investigations about how did he become a top student. Now, this story is about cheating. And more than cheating, and because we know of instances when kids cheat, but they do it often, you know, either on their own or maybe with the complicity of their friends. But here's a story of the complicity of parents in cheating. And I'm just kind of interested in the psychology of children, you know, of parents when they help their kids cheat.
Well, I think this is as much a failure of the education system as our meaning Asians, we being Asians, a preoccupation with mugging when we're studying, mm-hmm. right? We try to memorize everything to get flying colors in the exam, not really understanding what the subject matter is all about. And I think more importantly, we don't have as much, arguably, debatably, as much as how the Western systems are to converse, to debate, know the subject matter and turn it around and talk to people about it. But also in a country like India and Malaysia, say, that education system fails in teaching our kids.
So to have a system that's very exam orientated, right? And I remember the first time I sat for an open book exam, and that blew my mind because I didn't know how to do it.
I thought, wow, this will be great.
I didn't need to study. I can just find the answers in the book. Yeah. But it clearly, that's not the case, right?
Yeah, because higher order questions are asked of you.
Yes, thinking questions.
Right? Mm. But I think coming back to the story, right, and it's about kids getting flying colors. Now, a lot of parents want to give their kids the best opportunities available, right? They want to open doors for their kids. They want to give their kids a legs up, leg up. And then this is the crux of it. Parents do this because they think they're helping their kids.
So do you remember, I think, was it last year, the UPSR, there was a scandal about the UPSR questions being leaked on WhatsApp. Do you remember that? The photos were taken and spread around. Now, I remember vividly being in a WhatsApp group where parents had shared this question, the photos, the images of the questions, saying that, well, you know, I don't know whether this is true, but maybe you want to help your kids out. And I remember thinking to myself, wait a minute, are you teaching your kids that it's okay to cheat? And the response was that, well, you know, they're being graded on a curve. If everyone has these questions, I don't want my child to miss out.
Well, there's also the question of, I'm still trying to follow the logic of the thinking, right?
So I struggled with the logic of that too.
So your opportunities, you want a level playing field, everybody else is cheating, then your kids should be allowed to cheat too.
It's like the doping scandal with Lance Armstrong.
No, but then there's this other thing, right? What do you think is the consequence? So I don't know what parents feel, right? If they're proud of their kid doing well, but then the kid is actually quite dull or dim or dense or whatever the D word you could use, that's not too rude to describe the child, then what is the purpose? So you could keep, then you'd have to keep cheating, right? So you cheat at one level, you're going to have to keep cheating in order to maintain their position. And how far and how long can you sustain that?
But it's a short-term game, this cheating.
So I mean, well, I don't think so. I think it becomes a long-term game, don't you think?
It sounds like it's not the fault of the parents, because ultimately the policymakers and the leaders and the governments would have to think about how to stop this gaming of the system, as it were, to really get to the bottom of the intention of education, which really is to allow us to have a kind of intellectual fulfillment and more to allow us to give us a stab in life. Right? So,
yeah, okay,
the cause as the consequences.
Well, just going back to this story, Shira, that you pointed out, in India, the parents actually climbed school walls to pass on answers for the exam. This isn't passive cheating. This isn't forwarding a WhatsApp
this is the
image.
Most
this
literal is version of cheating.
Active cheating.
Well, no, okay, so.
Premeditated cheating.
You know, like climbing over a wall to give your kids the answers.
Yeah. No, Julian's point, a very important thing. There are structural issues. Right, I mean, the whole system kind of encourages this because it puts so much emphasis on the end result, meaning that number. But can you then absolve parents of the individual, personal, ethical, and moral issues involved in this? Right. And also, I think there's a pedagogical one as well, meaning that parents have to think, what is it that they want their kids to develop? I mean, you might have the certification, but if behind that certificate is a really dull mind, a mind that's not been challenged, a mind that's lazy, and that can't, in fact, respond adequately to a question like, what is political science? Then what have you achieved with your kid? Because how long can you protect them from the real world?
The certificate is an easy thing to quantify. You know, it's a lot more subjective and qualitative to weigh the intelligence of a child, whereas a certificate is a straight A, B, C, or a pass or a fail.
Well, you know, I think it's very clear, political science is about politics and domestic science is about cooking. Well, at least
I think it's not about
it.
Science, right?
Maybe it's about politics. Well, domestic science is the term we give to, home economics.
But I think there is also an income dimension to this. If you're making ends meet and living in hand-to-mouth situations, then you have too many things to think about, survival issues, than the mundane stuff like passing an exam, right? But you know at the back of your head that this is important for the future of your child. So let's get it over and done with. Let's have our children passing. And this is an issue of social mobility as well. The very rich parents and their kids would have that stab at upward mobility than the bottom rung of society. And that's why ultimately is not really their fault because they're just trying to get things done.
I like the way you try and get these parents off the hook. I just can't see why we can't survive.
No, it's really about survival.
I think that's the debate, right? You can see it from all points of view.
Yeah, I mean, the thing is, you must critique the system, but you cannot absolve individuals from their moral responsibilities.
No, I can't. And I have not looked at the background of these parents in this article because I think the article is not detailed enough, but I suspect that they are from very poor families.
Yeah. No, so I suspect that, in fact, they're from middle class.
Okay, so hypothetical scenario. Let's say they were poverty. It's a poverty-stricken area. They're struggling to break out of their circumstances and they see education as a way to do it. And this is a really important test. Say it's a university entrance exam. So let's say this. All your hopes and dreams for your child hinges on this one exam. Does that make it justifiable they did?
And remember that story about how an Italian judge ruled that if you were poor and hungry and you stole bread, you have not committed a crime, right? And same situation?
No, this hypothetical situation.
I think we're talking about middle class families, really. But anyway, before we wrap this up, Sheikh Shahir has tweeted and he says, when I was in college, we signed ethics agreements. During exams, professors would walk out of the hall reminding us that we'd signed them. So I think there's a question of ethics and personal responsibility. And also, cheating ultimately is an act that damages yourself, right? But we'll have more after the 8:30 news, which is coming out right now with Nadia Abdulaziz. BFM 89.9, you're listening to The Morning Run, and that was Cubism Dream by Local Natives. A very appropriate song, because what we're going to be talking about next is art, because there was that Cubist moment in the 20th century, you know, with Picasso and a whole range of other artists. But before that, I'll just introduce the voices that you'll be hearing for the next, you know, 15 minutes prattling on about art. You'll hear Julian Ng.
Howdy.
You'll be here listening to Melissa Idris.
I can't top the howdy now.
I know. Yeehaw! And I'm Sharad Kutad. And it's now 40 minutes past 6 in the morning. I'm going to be tweeting this link out. It's a story that comes from the New York Times about art that's not on walls, but behind walls and fences. And it's got to do with the art market and how people who buy art don't always buy art for the pleasure of it. They buy it for the value and its ability to gain value over time.
I think that's indisputable, because the classical economics would tell you that prices are based on supply and demand. And when these great artists come up with their work, you know, there's very little supply of it. And over time, it's natural that these prices of these works would skyrocket. So that one we can accept as the truth, right?
Okay.
But whether it's right to do that or not, it's a different question.
Okay, so I think that picture of scarcity has to be nuanced a little bit, because each work is kind of unique, right? It's not a question of having only four mules, and the market, you know, demand is for six mules. But it's really that individual artists over their lifespan might produce a limited number. So you can say, well, why shouldn't artists then just produce one or two? And that wouldn't work either, because artists have to produce a critical mass, a body of work, before they can, in fact, give value to that, to the work they
but
do.
But what they feel is a kind of critical mass would not be still a lot for the world. It's not enough for the world to absorb, especially if you're a good artist.
Okay, so what the New York Times is trying to say here is that, you know, they've come across this trend where there are now more and more free ports. So ports where they don't charge tax for art collectors to store their collections. Apparently millions of works, including about 1,000 pieces of Picasso paintings, have been stashed in storage. And the question is, should these owners be storing them away because they're waiting for the price of the pieces of art to increase in value, rather than hang it on the walls for public consumption? So is art considered a free public good, a private property?
I think it's a great idea. I think there is support for that idea that art should be for the public, because we can learn a lot from it. There is value in analyzing the meaning behind those works, right? So this is like a platform that is being provided by, let's say, Alibaba or eBay or something, where you could go in there and being offered services like security, and people from other places like professors, art professors and curators can go in there and help the public understand these works.
Yeah, that's what we call a museum.
This is different from the museum. This are private works put up on the platform as a holding place for you to store while you wait for these art prices, these works to go up, right?
Well, you know, then there's the question: who pays for the cost of the curation, the cost of maintenance? You know, I mean,
that's the reason why they're stashing it in these tax reports.
The freemium economy comes in, right? Who pays for the Wikipedia entries? Nobody. And they're up there because people are passionate enough to share information.
Yeah, but information is not the same as a physical object, a canvas with oils or acrylic.
Which needs to be insured and, climate control.
So, the rooms, temperatures, dust. I mean, there are all kinds of things that are different from, a Wikipedia entry, right? So
I think that you can tweak and refine the platform to make it palatable for these people to store their art pieces there. I mean, you could incorporate security and the right kind of, environment for the art pieces to survive.
Again, it's a question of cost, right? It's not going to be free. If you're going to have security, especially of works which are very valuable. We're talking about works that, you know, are in the millions, perhaps. So how would you do that? And, you know, and who would pay for
that? That's a good question. And yeah. I think it's a matter of execution. But the idea is a great one, I feel, because then we can have access to...
Well, the idea at this point is just to store it.
To store it.
That's the practice
not
now,
to use
right?
It, yeah. Not to hang it up. Yeah,
not to display it, right?
But, I mean, is it just for paintings? Because art comes in so many shapes and forms, right? Can you argue that jewelry is art? And should that be then on display rather than under lock and key?
Yeah, so we're talking about fine art. We're talking about
paintings,
installations.
Okay. Or sculpture.
Or sculpture and those kinds of things. We're not including a live performance or performance art. So what, because storing performance artists would be very painful. I think that they make a lot of fuss about it. But again, coming back to this idea, just because art can be something for the public, doesn't mean that you can't own it, as you would any other object. Mm. And if you have personally collected artworks, you go and you go to the gallery and buy artworks, why should you have an obligation to share it, at any point in your life, including when you pass on or, you know, shuffle off that mortal coil, and should you then just give it to your, people who are going to inherit your other properties?
So yeah, it's a question of ethics, isn't it? Because legally, you're not compelled to share what you own. This is, to me, on the same level as, let's say, owning an island or owning a hill somewhere, a park somewhere. Should you share that with the public?
Well, for me, it's about art as an investment rather than for the appreciation of it. I'm going to buy this painting because I know in a few years' time it's going to escalate in price for sure. It's going to go up to maybe tenfold, for instance. And I'm going to keep it until the price actually does go up. So these private wealthy owners probably see this as an investment and see no obligation to share art as
public
good.
But can you still make money out of it and share it at the same time? I think that's the more important question. And I believe that it should be shared because these are great works, right?
No, they're not necessarily. We don't see that's one thing we don't know yet. We're assuming that because they have some sort of market value or the people who bought them think they have a value that can appreciate over time, that they're necessarily great works. I mean, the whole idea of great works, it's much harder to kind of grasp, right? It's more than just the market value. I wonder, on the flip side, I wonder how artists think of it, people who sell the works. So we're talking about living artists rather than old masters whose works are still being, still circulating in the art market. Are they concerned that their works are not, displayed? And you can imagine, even some local collectors in Malaysia, I mean, some of the big local collectors have literally hundreds or thousands of artworks and they don't have enough wall space to put them all up at the same time. So art does go into storage in private collections. Art does go into storage even in public collections, like museums or galleries don't always display all their works all the time. So, is storage itself necessarily a bad thing?
There is also the question of the struggling artist, right? And the fact that, is it true, Sharad? I may be wrong here.
I've never been a struggling artist.
A lot of the revenue does not go to the artist. In fact, goes to the distributor, the gallery. And a lot of the very valuable work that we see today are accorded, the price rise of which happens posthumously, not during the artist's lifetime. For example, Van Gogh was really a struggling artist during his lifetime. So there is also that question, you are sequestering these pieces of art for your own private collection and really taking advantage of the lion's share of that value appreciation without giving back
to
something
the
to the public.
Yeah,
the artist.
The artist, right? But I don't know. It could be said it's a willing buyer, willing seller situation. Artist sells their work directly or through a gallery, in which case the gallery gets a cut because the gallery stores it. It then, has to evaluate it. It's got its own Rolodex of possible buyers. I mean, whatever value the gallery brings, it charges for it, right?
Yeah.
The question is that relationship exploitative? I think you have to look at each individual situation to see whether that is true. But beyond that, if somebody's bought a piece of work, and I've over the years bought artworks, but I cap it at 400 ringgit, by the way. I always go for struggling
artists.
That's
your strategy.
My strategy is always buy cheap and only ever buy cheap. But, if I decide to sell that work, the artist gets no cut of that secondary sale, right? And it's like buying a house. I mean, yeah, so the original owner doesn't get anything when you and the property passes to other hands. I mean, is that fair to the artist? I don't know. It's a curious one.
I think the artist should be compensated fairly so that they can make a living and they can continue doing the good work that they have.
I don't know
what it means, but I don't think people who produce good works, and it includes musicians and other people of the craft and artisans, they, I think, should be given a chance. And it's not always clear-cut that it should be a market-driven transaction. And after that transaction has been done, there is also the question of what you owe to the public. You may still legally own it, but what is your responsibility to the public, especially when you are keeping all these good stuff away from the eyes of the public?
I don't know. I mean, if there was this obligation to share your private property when it comes to fine art with the public, would that deter people from wanting to own fine art? You know what I mean?
Yeah. I mean, I know you create a hypothetical scenario where you say, well, if I own it, it's mine.
It's mine.
Right? But if I buy a Picasso, do I have a right to destroy it? If I buy a book,
I could trash it. If I buy a Sherrod Kutin painting, do I need to destroy it?
I can sell you some right after this, Melissa.
That could be art as well, destroying certain artists' work. Right?
But the thing is, it's a very important question, because then maybe questions are raised. If I don't have a right to destroy a Picasso that's in my possession, that I paid good money for, then maybe I don't quite own it in the way I think I own it, right? Lots of questions around.
Yeah, and same question, just to follow up. If I bought a sanctuary for birds or for endangered species, do I have the right to destroy that biodiversity there?
Oh, right. Okay, so again, much more, because, we're talking about one object versus an ecosystem.
But
or part
it
of an
can
ecosystem.
Be applied in so many things.
Yeah, so the question again is whether our analogies work, right? I mean, can we apply the same principles to very different objects? And I think that's the crux of the matter. We tweeted out the link to this. So far, I haven't got a response on Twitter yet to this rather
exciting
discussion about
pleading.
Are we pleading? Yes. So that is the New York Times, one of the world's greatest art collections hides behind this fence. And you can tell from the headline, perhaps some of the editorial slant in the piece, they do think it's a problem. What we're going to be talking more about business and politics in the next three hours rather, and coming up soon is the business. Sorry, is the second
Market
bulletin,
Watch, yeah.
The second bulletin of the day on BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.